Investigating truth in a world of lies. You are listening to the John Age Project.
Trust no one. Trust no one. Trust no one.
Welcome to the Anomic Age. I am indeed your host, John Age. Thank you very much for joining us today on this post 4th of July edition of the Anomic Age. The last couple episodes have been a little bit out of sync. To be completely honest, had some family stuff going on, had to go out of town for, you guessed it, 4th of July. So I had one show recorded in advance, and then this one's going to come out after the 4th of July. So I apologize for not having a proper 4th of July edition for the Anomic Age. But the content's there. I just don't have a specific red, white, and blue fireworks going off 4th of July edition of the program. But we'll talk about it just a bit in the broad strokes today, for sure. As always, please visit AnomicAge.com if you haven't already done so. Check out the homepage, AnomicAge.com. You can find past guests, the current guests that we're going to talk about today, You can find information about me. You can sign up for the newsletter on the sort of middle to bottom right there. And at the bottom right, you can absolutely, and I cannot recommend this enough, donate to the Anomic Age, right there. You can click at the donate button, it'll take you to a PayPal link, and you can donate to Anomic Age there, to the Anomic Age, to me, to John Age, to this program, this broadcast, this thing that's going on right now. So you can donate right there. You can also go to paypal.me/AnomicAge and donate there. You can go to Twitter, just look for at Anomic Age, and you can find the PayPal link right there on the main Twitter, Anomic Age homepage, if you will. So check out all that. Please do that. I don't underscore these points enough, but it's important. I just, in the past weekend, had to fork over another, for me, large sum of money to keep the homepage up and running and keep things going as they should be. So it's not cheap. Every little bit helps. So if you can't donate $10 or $15, I don't care. You can donate a couple bucks, and I'll be more than happy to thank you for that generous donation. This stuff's not cheap. It's all coming out of my pocket. There's no sponsors. There's no George Soros. There's no NPR money. There's no federal funding. It's just John funding right now. And make no mistake about it, eventually, as the program grows and succeeds, we're going to have a paid version that you can pay for. With the Patreon link and so forth, we're not there yet. And to be honest, I have not done my due diligence and taken the time to set that up because there's a whole lot of other stuff going on. I know I got to do the due diligence and get in there and make this happen. So, as always, if the show's doing great or if the show's doing bad, the buck still stops here. That being said, we'll have those things up soon. And sooner than later, I hope. I know people are still probably out there going, hey, I wouldn't mind a sticker. I wouldn't mind a shirt. You know, something to pass out and stick in mailboxes. It's coming too, I guarantee it. Not coming right now. Not coming in July, perhaps. But sooner than later. But until then, you can do your own due diligence and get out there and spread the word. Post it on your message boards. Post it on Reddit. Post it on Twitter. Post it on Facebook. Post it on anything you want that you're legally able to do, that is. As always, word of mouth is kind of the best way to get things like this off the ground, especially in the age of extreme Orwellian censorship that we are living under. So, talk to your friends at the water cooler, mention it at the grocery store, when you're in the checkout line, while everyone around you is sitting there playing with their little cancer light box. You can say, hey, hear about this show? There's this guy. He does this thing, and it's great. AnomicAge.com. Check it out. No, not atomic, you dimwit. Anomic. The age we're living in. The age where everything is not what it seems, where everything is inverted, where left is right, up is down, and truth is lies. That's what we're living in. That's the anomic age in a nutshell. Oftentimes people are like, well, that's anomic. I don't know what that means. Yeah, that's what it is. It's the bizarro world satanic death cult that we live in. I couldn't use bizarro world satanic death cult. The URL's too long, and I don't have the money to use the term bizarro world from the comic book clowns. I can't do it. So anomic age it is. Kind of more apropos. It's less lengthy and more to the point. So, do your part. You're listening to this after the 4th of July, but hopefully you've listened to all the other shows preceding this one, and while you're at the 4th of July with those freaky family members that don't believe anything like this is possible, and they're just drinking the Kool-Aid, going, I love Barack Obama, I wish he was still here. Oh man, Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton, they were the best. You can say, hey, you might want to do a little bit of research. Look into reality once in a while and check out this show, AnomicAge.com, with this guy. So you can do all that. Pre or post 4th of July. You can do it all the time. AnomicAge.com. Please, share the link with your friends, family, loved ones, and enemies. Help the show grow. Okay. That being said, I'm already talking, what were we, like 6-7 minutes into the show? And we've relatively discussed nothing. The show today is going to be great, as it always is. It's going to be huge. But, considering we are a little post-4th of July, everyone's probably had a long weekend, and this guest is definitely going to be bringing a wealth of information to the table. But first, I'll give you the very abbreviated version of the news today. I'm not even going to get into anything but one story. That's how abbreviated it is. And when I say that, a lot of people are like, we love the news segment. We love it when it's just you riffing on stuff and hating stuff. And being the real you that you are. Realness. But, considering a lot of other people are probably going, man, I can't handle a 3 to 4 hour broadcast. Sure, a lot of other people do it, but let's try to keep it a little bit under the 2 minute mark. Which right now we're already well over 2 hours. So, I guarantee you the show will be lengthy. So if you're not into a lot of information, you should probably just watch Fox News or one of those other Itty Box shows, and you can just get 30-minute segments bookended by all kinds of medical mafia stuff that'll kill you, and a lot of GMO cancer-ridden food that'll kill you. So you can watch something else, is what I'm trying to say. This program's got a lot of information, and even the longer shows, I've had a show up to about 2.5 hours, and I've probably, some people out there going, oh, it's way too long. Yeah, that wasn't even scratching the surface. The guests that were longer than an hour or even into 2 hours and more, believe me, we didn't even scratch the surface. On those really long episodes, it wasn't me not talking because I just didn't have anything to say or couldn't come up with anything brilliant or pontificate or pinkies out. No, I was trying to hold myself back because the guest was bringing such great information to the table that I didn't want to interrupt and sidetrack them and jagland and just start talking about something crazy. So that's what's going on with these extremely, they're not long to me, but some people may consider a longer episode. I've gotten that too. Why don't you cut back the show into these short little sound bites? And I'm not doing that. I'm not going to cut the show into little 15-30 minute segments. That's not my style. If that's your way of learning, that's great. But again, probably not the show for you because we got a lot more information than we can possibly even harness into a 2 hour segment, let alone trying to condense that into these little 15-minute sound bites. You know, that's a millennial thing. That's something that's really been promulgated in the last 20 years. That's not me. I'm into a lot of information. I get, when someone gives me these little 15-minute segments, and I'm like, and then what? And it's kind of like this Alfred Hitchcock cliffhanger. You're like, and then what happened? And well, we'll talk about it next week, Bob. Yeah, we're not doing that. We're going to give you not the full Monty, but as much of the full Monty as we can possibly give you without making it, you know, a Roots anthology series. That's why almost all these guests, I'm like, we got to talk later. We got to talk again down the road because there's just so much to discuss. That being said, today's show, I guarantee you, will be longer than an hour. But the information that's going to be delivered will be well worth your time. This is great stuff for driving. I mean, if you're on the road in traffic, well, don't say in traffic, because if you're listening to stuff in traffic, it will probably agitate you and make you more volatile. Especially long road trips. If you got time in the shower, if you got time on a long road trip, this is a great way to wind down at night. For my money, I listen to a lot of this sort of material at night, and I know this isn't a good thing because it, to some people, it disturbs their sleep. To me, it's kind of my quiet moment when I get to sit there and just cogitate and bring in more information. Everyone's quiet. I can listen to all this factual data and start putting little points on the map. Okay, that connects over here and over there. What about this we heard a couple nights ago? It's not uncommon for me to make notes all the time about this stuff. Believe me, this is a real thing. I have a legitimate notebook of information. I need to make it a bigger notebook because I'm running out of room in that one. But, you know, whatever floats your boat. You can make this into 15-minute segments if you want. If you just want to listen to 15 minutes a day, if your brain is on overload, by the time you get past the new segment of this show and you're going, I can't take it anymore, John. I feel like getting a hammer and going to commit a felony. Nope. Just cut the show off. Pick it up another time. It's okay. It's all right. Just relax. Don't relax too much, though, because I think people relaxing is indeed the problem. Speaking of our new segment for the day, and the only one that we'll discuss, here it is. If you're listening to this probably the weekend after the 4th of July or during the week after the 4th of July here, this is old news to you, or at least it's old news by a week, perhaps, but this has really been disturbing and irritating to me. This is coming from the EpochTimes.com, and it made it on a number of news outlets, pretty much any of the major news outlets you can think of and the small and medium ones in between. This was on it. USA News from the Epoch Times by Janita Khan, July 1st, 2019. Updated July 2nd, 2019. Attorney for journalist Andy Ngo warns of legal action against Antifa. And this was sort of the follow-up to the original story where this journalist Andy Ngo, N-G-O, I'm pronouncing that possibly correct, possibly completely incorrect. So Andy, if that's incorrect, I sincerely and humbly apologize from the bottom of my heart. Back to the story and what you should be getting from this. This is sort of the follow-up article for the initial news article, which was that Andy Ngo was attacked at Portland, Oregon. I don't know what you want to call these things. I'm trying to censor myself from telling you in the uncensored, very rough cut, broad strokes as to what I think this stuff is. But this journalist was out there covering some more fun Antifa protests, incidences. I'll just call these scumbags what they are. They're communist scum, and they're out there destroying stuff and showing themselves. And I'm reeling it in a lot because that's putting it very nicely. So Andy was out there covering this, and he was assaulted by these clowns. And it shows him on there where he's got some silly string on him. And, you know, the initial reports are going to say, oh, it's just silly string. It's no big deal. And then his face is covered with some sort of white substance, which they're saying is milkshakes. But other reports are saying that these Antifa thug clowns were putting bits of cement in with the milkshakes and pelting these people with them. And this gentleman here is only one of the people. If you look on a lot of these other sites, I pulled this off Twitter, but there's fill-in-the-blank social media sites have this. It shows another gentleman that had his head split open in several areas, all kinds of staples and stitches in his skull because of these violent pieces of dog manure known as Antifa. And it just goes on and on and on. It's just more of the norm, more of what you would expect. And I've heard people comment on there and say, oh, well, this gentleman had some sort of attack gloves on, like the Antifa scumbags. And I guess they're talking about the gloves that have sort of little plastic pieces right here, so you can hypothetically punch something and not sustain as much damage to yourself, but perhaps more damage to that person. I guess that's what they're saying this journalist may have had. I don't have any evidence of that, so if that's factual or not, feel free to send me some information. John@anomicage.com. I don't know that to be true at all. I don't care if it's true or not. I think the notion of attack gloves is kind of like assault rifles. I think assault rifles and assault gloves and all this is just more silly adulteration of language by the communists. That's all it is. Silliness. I don't care if he had the gloves on or not. The kid was beaten about the face, you know. He's got stuff thrown all over him. And the article I'm reading here, attorney for journalist Andy Ngo warns of legal action. Take that deep breath and oxygenate your brain as much as possible before you proceed. I say warns my foot. Why is anyone warning of anything? Don't warn. That's akin to warning. We're going to drop some bombs on the enemy. We're going to drop some bombs on the enemy. Let's send out leaflets and make... Yeah, that's stupid. That's idiotic. That's imbecilic and deranged. You don't warn the enemy when you're going to drop bombs nor conduct a raid. That's idiotic and stupid. Attorney for this guy, you don't warn them what you're going to do. You bleep and do it. I get so disgusted about all the inaction going on around here. And this Antifa case here, again, in Oregon, is just another case of the same old, same old. Everybody wants to sit there and wring their hands. Well, we're going to warn them of some action, and we might just do some pressing of charges. Who cares? Do it. There's an old parlance that I'm reeling in from saying here. But basically, do it or don't. I'll clean it up quite a bit. Do it or don't. That's where I'm at. Do it or don't. Don't warn people. Don't tell them you're thinking about doing it. Don't tell them you're going to do it. Just do it. I always come back to this point. Be people of action, not reaction. Okay? Stop reacting. Stop looking over your shoulder. We're going to do something. Stop reacting and act. That's the biggest problem in America and quite possibly the world as we know it. Stop reacting to the globalist communist scum that are out there. Don't do that. React. Just act. It's so ridiculous. And stop expecting other people to save you. I touched on this last time. I'll hit it again. Trump's not going to save you. Q's not going to save you. The sheriff's not going to save you. The police aren't going to save you. Nobody's coming over the hill. That's all just a bunch of bunk. The only person that's going to save you is the person in the mirror. That's the person that's going to save you. Now, if you can somehow manage to find a couple of other people that are on that same page and somehow aren't FBI agents, you can help them. They can help you. That's how community works. But stop expecting it to come from the top. It's not happening. Not happening. Not happening. Oh, but there's going to be still... No, there's not. Shut up. You're an idiot. If it happens, great. If it doesn't, great. People have to stop expecting someone else to do it and look in the mirror and do it. Like I always say, if all these hypotheticals come to pass, great. Take a long look at history. Read a book. George Washington, Ben Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, Thomas Paine, George May. You can keep on going down the list. Not one of those men did what we do now. Not one of those men got up in the mirror and thought to themselves, wow, I really hope that somebody helps us. Somebody's going to save us. Somebody's going to come over that hill at Lexington and Concord. Somebody's going to come over that hill at the Alamo. Somebody's going to come over that hill. Fill in the blank, man. Fill in the blank. They didn't do that. They were men of action. So our society now has inverted upon itself. And we're no longer people of action. We're people of reaction. It's like the whack-a-mole game.
Oh, somebody got hit in the head in Oregon. Oh, man, what are we going to do? What are we going to hope Trump does something?
Let's wring our hands. Let's wring our hands and post about it 1,000 times and talk to all the echo chamber people about it. It'll be great. And then what? And then when it happens again, we'll rinse and repeat and do the same bleeping thing again. So stop. It just doesn't make any sense. Oh, let's roll down to some more things in the same article that are quite disgusting. Let's see, where are we at here? Mayor? I'm trying to find his exact name so I don't mess it up. Mayor Wheeler, if I'm not mistaken? Yeah, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler. And this is coming from the quotes here. Allegedly ordering his police officers to maintain a supposed hands-off, a Biden-off approach during the assaults. Again, no one is surprised. Why would anyone be surprised? Why is anyone surprised that this is occurring? Why is anyone surprised that this is occurring in a communist scumhole? Why is this anyone surprised that this is occurring at the behest of a communist piece of scum as their mayor? Why is anyone surprised? And why isn't anyone acting instead of sitting around reacting? I mean, I guess I'm as guilty as everyone. I'm doing the same thing. I'm just covering the inaction is what I'm doing. So, you know, everyone's aghast. Oh, Ted Wheeler, I can't believe. I can't believe he would do that. I can. He's a... You know what he is. But in saying that, everyone seems to be letting the police off the hook. I'm not letting the Republicans, the Democrats, the cops, the military, anyone off the hook. If you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing, you're on the hook. So in this incident, the mayor is culpable, sure. The police are equally, if not more, culpable. I'm done with the we're just following orders narrative. That's the biggest bunch of baloney. It didn't work in World War I, II, and the preceding, and the after wars either, and it doesn't work here. It's just a load of hockey. The police were just following orders, so they just stood down and watched the reporter get beaten. They watched numerous other people. I've just seen two of the most vicious accounts of people getting beaten. So the police, in their infinite wisdom, just stood down. They just stood down. And the problem is, this isn't an isolated incident. Is it UNC, Chapel Hill? Is it an isolated incident when your cops just stood down too? Is it an isolated incident when it happened again in Oregon and Washington State and all the other places that you would expect it? I mean, just go back in the last year or two and look at all the incidences of the police standing down. But these same people are still going to roll the banner up for the police and talk about how great they are and heroic they are. In some cases, perhaps, but certainly not here. Police stood down while people got beat viciously. And the police just sat there, I guess, holding their hands, swinging their batons. Heck, I don't know. I wasn't there. I don't know how the police can do this. I don't know how the average human can do this or anyone with any sort of, again, human quality can do this. Someone next to you is sitting there getting beaten down by a gang of feces, numerous people here just getting beaten. And you're just standing there, I guess. I don't know. You're watching it from your little drone footage. You're watching it from little cameras that you got all over the city. That's what's up. You're just watching it go down, right, police? Nothing's happening? So to my point, I've echoed this a few times, but if your paycheck and your benefits is more important than the Republic and more important than your supposed oath to protect and serve the people, if the benefits and the monies are more important than that, then you need to quit. Quit. Don't call yourself a police officer. Quit. You're not helping the people. You're helping yourself. If you are following unconstitutional orders, you're no different than the thugs beating people down in the street. No apology. That's fact, Jack. Realness. Yeah, if you're just following orders and letting that occur, how are you any different than all those other just following orders folks that we know all too well? 30s Germany, 40s Germany. Just following orders too, right? They had to make sure their benefits were secure. They had to make sure they're still getting paid. Just following orders. Doesn't cut it. So at some point in the game, you have to do something. You can't do everything, but you can do something. That's how I close the show, every show. You can't do everything, but you can do something. What are you doing? I don't know. Nonetheless, let's take a brief moment and relax and just harness your chi and meditate to your cow or whatever. Nonetheless, we indeed have a great episode today. We have a great episode today. I've mentioned before our episodes are a little bit out of sequence. And this episode is one that I've wanted to release for a long time. I recorded it almost a month and a half ago, almost 2 months ago, I think. I recorded an interview with Cody Snodgrass. And the way that the shows were going at the time, I managed to get a hold of him and actually get the interview done in sort of a very quick fashion. I'd already done one interview that day for the upcoming week, and then he called and was able to work it in. And I know everyone's time is valuable. So he said, hey, I can do it in an hour, and I wasn't about to say no. And the way the shows had already been slotted in the calendar for the next month and a half, 2 months, it just wasn't really an easy fix to just sort of throw that in there in the shuffle. And it was such an important episode. I knew that people wanted to hear it in its entirety. I knew people wanted to hear it without a long diatribe and segments and adding it to this week and that week. I hate doing that. So, we have the full Cody Snodgrass interview today for your post 4th of July week / weekend. It's a great episode. He's covering a lot of information and he's really hitting a lot of the points that I wanted to get into for a long time. And full disclosure, it's been hard to find people that want to talk about these things. I'll always say this, the 90s was a forgotten decade. For better or worse, I mean, the Clintons were running that regime for most of that decade. And for whatever reason, people don't want to talk about it or aren't interested in talking about it anymore. Or maybe they just think the audience isn't there that wants to hear that information. But I see that information just as pertinent as the Kennedy assassination, just as pertinent as World War I and World War II, Federal Reserve, all that information links very cohesively together and leads us to where we are today. But for whatever reason, the 90s stuff kind of just gets lost in the mix. And I hate that. So this is a great interview. I'm real excited to have him on the show. Hopefully we're going to get in contact with him again and really get into more information. As I alluded to earlier, this isn't even the tip of the iceberg as to what this gentleman has to contribute to that era and how it connects us to where we are now. It was coming from a person who I think myself knows quite a bit about all that information. I've studied it exhaustively, lots of documentaries, lots of books, lots of hours of going through information and interviews and so forth and so on. He was shining light on a lot of things that I had not heard about, and I was conspicuously silent through a lot of this interview because I was sitting there like taking mental notes and taking back about a lot of that information. So, nonetheless, the Cody Snodgrass interview will be today. And as he mentioned in our interview, a lot of this information tends to disappear from Google. And this was even before a lot of the more recent censorship in the last month and a half. So, I don't know how long this is going to be. This is going to be on YouTube-style platforms, Google, Facebook, and so forth. It'll definitely be on Brighteon, so you can hopefully always find it there if you can't find it on YouTube. I'll put the Brighteon video link as the primary on anomicage.com so you can see it there as well. But without further ado, I'll stop yammering. We'll get straight into the interview. Please share the link, friends, family, loved ones, and enemies, anomicage.com. Let's transition, shall we, into the Cody Snodgrass interview. Stay with us for just a mere matter of moments more. Thank you. It is my distinct pleasure and privilege to welcome Cody Snodgrass to the program today. Cody was recruited as an independent contractor with the CIA due to SAT test scores, top 1% in U.S. in physics at ETSU. After that, SFASU, master's degree program in physics, he worked for Chevron Amoco Oil Companies as a civilian front and was part of CIA Black Ops. Offered the Black Ops job at Oklahoma City in October 1994 and turned that one down. Wow, Cody. I hate to just start the program off with a wow, but thank you so much for being on the program. Thank you for the time, sir.
Yeah, we appreciate it. We've done a lot of interviews around over the last November 2017 when we broke the story about the murder building. We have it detailed in our 700-page book, Choosing the Light, Dark Secrets of the Oklahoma City Bombing. And people here in the U.S. can get that by emailing me at CodyGoldenElk@yahoo.com. I'm part Cherokee Indian, and that's my Indian name, CodyGoldenElk@yahoo.com. So we've been under real heavy censorship. Our websites have been hit, PayPal, Sprint, all hacked repeatedly. We're on our third set of computers where they keep sending us viruses and so forth. So, we've been trying to break the story and also get the corruption out about the Clintons and the Bushes, the Gulf War syndrome with the cover-up by the DOD, the Department of Defense, regarding the depleted uranium munitions that were used for the very first time in war in January 1991, and also the anthrax vaccine cover-up of our Gulf War troops. We had approximately 480,000 of our troops that were given these new anthrax vaccines, and so that's all detailed. So we got a lot to cover, and we can just go wherever you like.
Man, you're speaking right out of my brain. I actually spoke about those two things, I think, two episodes ago. In my news segment, I was talking about the squalene and the anthrax vaccines and how the Gulf War One was used as this big sort of testing ground with the depleted uranium rounds and the chemical weapons. And wow, if you'd like to kick things off there, or we can go all the way back to the Clintons and Waco and OKC and all that stuff.
Yeah, there's even been rumored now, if you fast forward, it's 2019, a lot of that stuff happened way back in January 91. That was when Gulf War started, and then Saddam invaded Kuwait, and we began our buildup over in Saudi Arabia in August of 1990. But the stuff they're using now, we've heard these are unconfirmed rumors. Let's say they have the Rods of God, satellite weapons that use uranium spikes. And they put them in chambers with micronukes. They detonate them, create a force, and they send those uranium rods, can send them down to the earth and create a huge explosion. And it's way past what was used in the Desert Storm conflict. Now, I don't know your listening audience, but we'll just need to get into a little history there in about that whole situation, because for the very first time in warfare history, the depleted uranium rounds were used on a large scale. And the two predominant, the weapon was, they had the silver bullet that was in the M1A1 Abrams tanks. And those rods are uranium-238. They're depleted. They come from depleted fuel rods out of nuclear power plants. And, they're maybe like a foot long, or so, and they're an inch to a half inch in diameter, and those weapons destroy by pure kinetic energy. They're approximately 5,200 feet per second, and when they're fired out of one of those cannons on the tanks, they'll hit a Soviet, like a T-72 tank. That's the predominant tank Saddam Hussein was using over there in Iraq. And those turrets weigh, roughly about 11 tons. And our rounds would hit them with such high kinetic energy that they'd blow up in a big fireball, and then those turrets would tumble quite a distance away. like a tumbleweed, you know, just 11 tons like it was nothing. But the problem we had, and you may have covered this on some of your other shows, is that that fireball was so hot and so big, and the Pentagon had never used these on a mass scale in war, so they really weren't aware of the secondary and tertiary effects.
Mm-hmm.
And when those things hit, they made that big fireball, and it was so hot that it actually made new molecular groups like uranium oxide and uranium dioxide and so forth. And the particulate size of these new molecules, once the explosion went away and it all settled down into the desert sand, they were approximately 4 microns in size. And our MOP gear for nuclear, biological, and chemical attacks that our troops wore, the filters in them, John, they only went down about 10 microns. So what our troops were doing, and no one really knew it at the time, was breathing this stuff in. And it concentrated, of course, in the thyroid glands and in the reproductive organs. So what they were doing was breathing this stuff. They didn't know it. They were slowly being poisoned without their knowledge by the depleted uranium, much like our troops in Vietnam were poisoned by the dioxin, commonly called Agent Orange,
yeah,
that was sprayed, you know, the Operation Ranch Hand. I think they started that after the Tet Offensive began in January of 68. Then they started spraying in Operation Ranch Hand. That was 1969 to 71, I believe that operation went, where they sprayed the highlands in Vietnam, you know, to get the canopies off the trees,
yeah,
so that we could see the enemy. And anyway, our troops, of course, absorbed that dioxin, and that led to the big settlement with DuPont Chemical, the Agent Orange settlement. And many of our Vietnam, I've got friends right now that have diabetes and congestive heart failure and so forth. You know, this stuff was 20, 30, 40 years later. It's real low-level exposure, and that's what they had in Desert Storm. Same thing, except it was radiation. Low-level amounts of radiation. Didn't really show up at once, but when our troops started coming home, they would make love to their wives, if you're a man, you know, and then this radiation would be transferred in the semen into their wives or partners, and then that would... If they had children, the half-life of this uranium is millions of years. So the Pentagon had that huge problem, and they didn't know how many generations down this radiation and the sickness that it caused would be transmitted. They call it the Gulf War Syndrome.
I'm glad you touched on that. I was going to throw that in. You know, this isn't something that just affected that soldier. It affected the wife, the offspring, and so forth.
Right, yeah, the Air Force, in our book here, we have some of the first lot numbers of the squalene anthrax vaccines. That's a whole other part of the Gulf War Syndrome we haven't talked about yet, but they call it failure to thrive syndrome. When the babies started being born, when our guys started coming back, you know, the babies, there was, you know, higher levels of autism and different things, and the babies were classified as failure to thrive. And it was due to this radiation. And that's one reason, you know, of course, in the book we detail all this highly of you know, leading to the Murrah Building, and the records of all this Gulf War Syndrome stuff were stored there. And we can go through the history of Iraq and what led up to the Gulf War, and go through the anthrax and squalene thing if you want. We can cover a lot of stuff. There's a lot of things to cover here. So the depleted uranium, though, was one aspect of the Gulf War Syndrome. And I have a friend here, he's a pilot there. They use the 30-millimeter chain guns, you know, in the A-10 Warthogs, you know, the tank buster aircraft. He was a pilot for the Air Force. Now he works for CIA at the... Space Command Center here in Colorado at Shriver Air Force Base in Colorado Springs. But, yeah, these depleted uranium weapons, that was the two primary configurations they used in Desert Storm, the aerial ones and the A-10s and then the M1A ones. and with the silver bullets, they called them. And that really made a mess. And a lot of people don't know this, John, but the United Nations went back into Iraq, oh, about 10 years later. It was just after the year 2000, 2001. The United Nations went in and they sampled with the medical records, and they found that in the 10 years since the Gulf War began in January 91, that the leukemia rates for children in Iraq had went up 600%.
Jesus.
And they attributed the reason for that was that there were approximately 200 tons of this depleted uranium stuff that the Pentagon admitted to using. Now, the actual number, God knows what that is. But they admitted to using approximately 200 tons of it. Now, you think about that in particulate size at 4 microns, 200
Jeez.
Tons. And that was spread over many areas, Samarra, you know, Baghdad, Qamishia, various areas in Iraq, and Mosul. And so, yeah, and so they have dates in Iraq. A lot of Americans don't know there's approximately 28 types of dates. And that's a big export in the Iraqi agricultural markets. And those dates are farmed and irrigated with water, and that water comes primarily from the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers.
Yeah.
Now, where all these battles occurred, where the A-10s used that depleted uranium, and you know the M1A1s and all the tank battles and all the stuff they did in southern Iraq, when Saddam's tank divisions that had, you know, entered Kuwait and then were retreating back up north to Baghdad, you know, all that area in there got sprayed with this stuff. And then Saddam set the oil well fires and all that kind of stuff. So there was a lot of particulates, hydrocarbon, long polymer chains, so forth in the hydrocarbons. That made another kind of pollution. But all of that, you know, eventually got down into the water where the rivers are. And then that stuff got into date crops, and the kids eat the dates, and then so 10 years after that war, part of the humanitarian thing, you know, we had our Gulf War syndrome problems over here in the States with our sick veterans, God bless their souls and their families, because a lot of them have suffered. They're suffering now in the VA hospitals as we speak.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Pentagon, of course, covered all that up. We have a cover-up thing in the book we can talk about later. But, yeah, the kids and the people of Iraq got sprayed with this low-level radiation. And it's still there today. And there's still sick people there today. And we don't hear a word, not a word about that in our state-controlled mainstream media. So, you know, the use of this type of uranium stuff had long-term secondary and tertiary consequences that were not foreseen by the Pentagon. And in the records of the medical culpability and the payments for all this stuff were stored at the Alfred P. Murrah Building. And when it was detonated, the building went up. McVeigh was, of course, a patsy. But when that building went up, all those records were destroyed. And then later, the Gulf War syndrome hearing, that was April 19th of 95 when the Murrah Building blew up. But later on, this was in, when was this? The congressional hearings in Gulf War syndrome were ongoing. One of the guys on the Armed Services Committee was Senator Christopher Shays, a Republican from Connecticut. He was tasked with, helping get some medical payments and culpability to our sick veterans. In September 19th of 1996, after the Murrah Building went up, they still had congressional hearings on Gulf War syndrome. And at those hearings, the DOD admitted that over 400,000 of the Gulf War syndrome medical records had, quote, disappeared, unquote. And we have a copy. Not, we couldn't include the whole DOD, you know, the transcripts of that hearing, but we have parts of it in the appendix to the book. So a lot of people don't know that there was a massive cover-up. Part of the bombing of the Murrah Building was the cover-up of the squalene vaccines, the anthrax vaccines that were used, and also the these depleted Iranian munitions that were used for the very first time. That was the heart of why the Oklahoma City bombing occurred. It was records destruction.
Jeez.
John, just like in the Pentagon, remember when Donald Rumsfeld
got on
TV and said there was like $2.3 trillion missing?
Uh-huh, right before 9/11.
And then when was that? The very next day?
No, that's right.
The very next day, 9/11 happened, and the section of the Pentagon that was supposedly hit, that was the section where they had like 50-some-odd accountants and a bunch of the information that was, these people were trying to find out where all that $2.3 trillion of missing money was. And we see the same pattern from the Murrah Building of records destruction to cover up a huge medical culpability from the DOD, all the records gone in that bombing. And then fast forward to 9/11, the Pentagon and all of its missing money, and then that's the records there, of course, hit. So we're seeing a pattern of very deep, I don't know the word to use. If I use some of the words I want to use,
yeah.
I think you probably censor this video. But, yeah, you know, so we're dealing with mass censorship. We're dealing with mass cover-up. We think shows like yours would be able to get some of this truth out to the American people. I know I'm kind of rambling, but it's a really big thing over there. We haven't even talked about the anthrax stuff yet. So,
yeah, I mean, I'm glad you started it right there because I think that's key. And it's something I've talked about a few times here, where I keep seeing the same playbook being used, and I think a vast majority of the American people just don't see the playbook. Like you just said, you know, they pulled this off with Oklahoma City to obfuscate those records and get out of paying all the veterans, and then they pulled the same bit with 9/11. And then we had the Waco incident, which the ATF termed as Operation Showtime, so they could make sure they kept getting their funding. And then coincidentally, that was around the same time as the Whitewater Clinton hearings. And
right.
I've pointed this out in another program, but, you know, when they were doing the Hammond raid and the Bundy raid here a few years back, I couldn't help but think, well, that seems a heck of a lot like what happened at Ruby Ridge when they were trying to demonize the sort of smoldering patriot movement that was happening around the time of the Clinton's first regime there with Bill.
Right. I've got a book here given to me. It was signed by Randy Weaver.
Mm-hmm.
He after his wife, Vicky, got shot. You know, Ruby Ridge, we have a small section in the book about that. You know, my story started back in 1974 when I took the physics SAT test in high school and then to get into college, and I scored the top 1% in the U.S., and then in 1975, that's why the CIA came to recruit me at East Texas State University, was because of those high test scores. But anyway, we go through a whole series of the 70s, 80s, 90s, and that Ruby Ridge thing happened up there. That was August 21st of 1992.
Mm-hmm.
There was about 400 federal agents surrounded that, and Vicky, his wife, was killed while holding a six-month-old baby. She was shot through the neck. Randy won a $3.1 million wrongful death lawsuit because of that. And he sent me a copy of his book. But, yeah, the whole thing with Ruby Ridge and Waco and then the Murrah Building, all that happened in the 90s. You know, Waco started February 28th of 1993. Then it ended April 19th of 1993 with 54 dead and 21 children dead when that big fire. And we have a story in the book, you know, about that. I knew one of the Branch Davidian guys, Ron Cole, who told me a completely different story about what really happened at Waco versus the federal cover story.
Really?
Then, yeah, 2 years later, then, of course, exactly to the day. You know, Tim McVeigh was at the Waco thing. Did you know that?
I heard that. I wasn't sure, but, I heard it.
Yeah, we could. So there's a lot to cover here, and we can drill down into anything like Waco or Ruby Ridge or the Murrah Building, or we can talk about the anthrax vaccines.
Sure.
So they all tie together. And the playbook you're talking about is something that a lot of Americans don't know about. And what we do is connect the dots And my partner, Ole Domegaard, runs a website, lightonconspiracies.com. I suggest people going to that, that there's a wealth of information on that. He covers in depth many of the false flag events, the Christchurch shootings in New Zealand, the recent Sri Lanka bombings, the Bali bombings in 2002. You remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and then there was the Sheffield bombing, of course, there in London, and so forth and so on. And so what we try to do is show the patterns. Not all of these events are false flag events, but many of them are. And they're made to look like, you know, lone gunmen, like Lee Harvey Oswald with the thing. They're made to look like a lone nut job, you know, Tim McVeigh in a Ryder truck. They're made to look... And then they use media control. But what we do is dig through them all, try to find what facts we can, and then show the patterns, like the Parkland school shooting, Sandy Hook shooting, Mandalay Bay there in Las Vegas, and so forth. And we have a wealth of information, but we condense it down in the playbook, like you're talking about. It starts to become clear that through time, there is a group, we call it the New World Order, who's orchestrating shadow government, intelligence agencies, orchestrating these events in a sequence, in a series, to create panic and fear and terror. And it's the old problem, reaction, solution scenario. They create the problem, they blow up a building, like the Murrah building or 9/11 or something, and then the reaction, of course, is all through the media. You know, oh my God, it's terrible, you know, what do we do? And then the solution is always the government riding in and, you know, taking away people's rights.
TSA, the airports, body scanners, yeah.
Right, right. And so what we're trying to do is help wake people up to the fact that we are being tricked and we are being conned by a very high-level group. These are international, multinational, and they go around the world like the Christchurch shooting. We did several interviews about that where we analyzed the very first footage of that thing when it very first hit the internet before they took it down. And then the videos were all deleted by YouTube. And then we interviewed with someone over in New Zealand. And they stopped the live stream in the middle of the live stream and wouldn't even let us talk because they know what they're doing. And they know they're creating these things, and then they're whipping them up. Some of these events didn't even happen the way they tell you on the news, you know, like the Murrah building. And so our job is to try to investigate, figure out. Ole Domegaard's had 35 years' experience investigating various assassinations and stuff. The information that's coming out now, John, is simply amazing. As long as we got people like you and truth-tellers and truth-diggers that go through all this mass amount. Most people don't have time to go through the mass amounts of information.
That's the truth.
It took me 4 years to write this book. It's 700 pages, and we did a lot of research went into this, and we sold it for $20. I mean, it's a really good deal for the amount of information and all the files. We have FBI and ATF, DEA 302s and various forms and all kinds of stuff in here. So I'm rambling here.
I love it, man. Yeah. Yeah, I'm kind of a nerd with all this stuff. I grew up and was in high school in the 90s, but I feel like I slept through it all. Like I didn't have any inkling as to what the heck was going on. I cared about skateboarding and going to punk rock shows, not about the Clintons and all that stuff. So as I got older, I really delved into all this stuff. I tried to get every old VHS tape I could get on all these different incidences and read as much as I could. So, I mean, it's something that I think, especially the younger crowd, they really need to do that. It's that old adage, if you don't know history, it's gonna repeat itself. So for me, when I saw this stuff going on a few years ago, I was like, oh, that's just like Randy Weaver. That's just like when they killed his family, you know?
Yeah, an interesting part of this book here, I was operational up until, let's see, I retired in March of 1995, 1 month before the Murrah building went off. I had my retirement party. And then, let's see, in October of 1994, that's when Harold Leonard offered me the job to bomb the Murrah building for $1 million in cash. And I turned that job down on patriotic grounds. Plus, by that time, John, in 1994, in the fall, I was operationally ineffective. I'd already been 20 years out in the muck and the mire of the black ops. We did stuff around the world, and I had many broken bones, nerve damage. I've been hit in the head several times with TBIs, concussions, and so forth. And I was also drinking heavily at that point, covering my PTSD, because my medical files now state that I'm 100% totally and permanently disabled with severe PTSD. So
yeah.
I wasn't effective, and they offered me that job, I guess, as a, you know, I figured it was a patchy job, and I tell the whole story in the book all in detail, but I figured they're going to kill two birds with one stone, you know, use somebody as a patchy, and then, you know, basically get rid of me. So like one of my handlers, Duke Plaglier, he did two tours in Vietnam and was a special forces over there with Barry Sadler. We tell those in the book. But he called me after I turned that job down and said, you know, you need to leave the country now. And I said, why? And he said, you turned from a CI asset to a liability. And we're going to stage you out of my place in Belize. He had a place down there. And then we'll get your ID changed and stuff and get you overseas. And I didn't, you know, I did not want to leave the country here. You know, I've got friends and family and so forth. And
so the
so
people,
I tell the story in this book.
I just want to jump in. So the people that were offering you this job, were these military? Were they CIA? Were they somewhere in the middle in that bizarre black op world?
Right, contractors.
Okay.
Errol Leonard had several IDs. You know, he was over in China and Southeast Asia and all that. And I don't know what his name was over there.
Gotcha.
But anyway, the point that I'm getting to, all this is detailed in this book. And I shut my mouth. I left the country for a little while and came back. And then by that time, McVeigh and Perry Nichols, his platoon commander over there in the Desert Storm 1, you know, McVeigh won Bronze Stars.
Mm-hmm.
One Bronze Star for confirmed kills in the Iraq War there, the Desert Storm. And they were all brought up, hauled up to the 10th Circuit. And then I was here in Colorado, and I ran into ATF agent Blake L. Butler. Now, the DEA and the ATF had an undercover operation in Colorado Springs, Colorado, that began in 1997. That was codenamed Operation Stingray. I got so many operations in my, you know, like Centaur Rose and Jade Bridge and Screwworm and Sea Spray and Snowmass and all the ones we were in the Clintons down there in Arkansas. And we talk about all those in the book, too. But anyway, I don't want to ramble here. What I want to do is just say that in that Operation Stingray, it was 2-year op from 97-99. That's where I met ATF agent Blake Butler. And we would find out later that Blake Butler had been at the Ruby Ridge fiasco for the ATF.
Mm-hmm.
And Ron Herucci, he was one of the snipers that came out later in court discovery with Randy Weaver when he won the $3.1 million wrongful death suit for his wife, Vicky.
Yeah.
That Ron Herucci was one of the guys that had shot at her. And then later on, Ron Herucci would show up at Waco in Sniper Nest number 7. And there was questions brought up about, you know, he put on his 302 reports. Those are after-action federal reports where they talk about their stuff they did that day. And, you know, he said he never fired any rounds at the compound there. But there was 308 Winchester brass found. You know, the common guns they used, John, were those bolt-action ADL and BDL Remington 308 rifles, you know, that's standard federal issue.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and so there was a bunch of brass laying in that sniper nest at number 7. So Ron Herucci's been around the block. And also Agent Blake Butler. He was at Ruby Ridge. We have video of him carrying out some of those dead ATF agents that were shot at the Branch Davidian compound. You can see his face clearly. He was at the Branch Davidian compound, and he was also, John, he was working at the Murrah building.
Oh, wow.
On 18th of 1995.
So we got him at all three crimes.
All three places. And he, I knew him for 2 years in this Operation Stingray. It's all detailed in this book here. And then while we were sitting around his house one day, the Columbine High School shooting had occurred up here.
Yeah.
And that was, at the time, one of the, you know, that was the biggest high school shooting in U.S. history.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And that was April 20th of 1999. Okay? And so we were talking to Bill Clinton, the president, and Janet Reno had flown into town up there in Denver, and they were capitalizing on the gun control stuff. And they were on TV, and we were sitting around talking. And Blake Butler was trying to buy some machine guns and some, he wanted some C4. And I said, look, we used to do all that stuff years ago. I drove truckloads of this stuff back in Centaur Rose in the ops we were in Arkansas around the MENA airport.
Yeah.
With Bill and Hillary Clinton. And so we were talking around there, and I started talking about CIA stuff. And I didn't know that we were on hidden 4mm cameras. They had two of them hidden in there. I started yapping about the pedophile rings in Arkansas and Bill and Hillary Clinton and all their sex stuff and the cocaine operations in MENA at the airport and the arms that were going down, you know, to the Nicaraguans. All this has been, it's a dead horse. I mean, people can watch all these interviews. It's been out for a long time about all this stuff. I think Tom Cruise made a movie about that.
Yeah, uh-huh.
About Barry Seal and all the pilots. I haven't seen that, but anyway, so we were sitting around talking about all this stuff, and they taped it. And 5 months later, the ATF, Blake Butler, planted me with false evidence. And this was a way for them to shut me up. And then they threw me in front of Judge Edward Nottingham up in the 10th Circuit Court in Denver. First, they offered me a deal to snitch, and I wouldn't do that because I know way too much. The CIA picked me up and ran me into the FBI, the DEA, and the ATF. And the guy said he flew out straight from D.C. to be with me that night, and they asked me direct questions about President Clinton, and I wouldn't talk to him. And then they stuck me in front of Judge Nottingham, who was nominated to his position by ex-director of Central Intelligence, George Bush Sr.
Oh, man.
Yeah, and so in the 10th Circuit Court, when Bill Clinton left Arkansas, they did all their crimes down there, which are all detailed in the book. They had a big body count and so forth.
Oh, yeah. A lot of Arkansides.
Yeah, one of my friends, Captain Glenn Wilson from Vietnam, who had later worked for the Defense Intelligence Agency, he, in 1979, helped him plan that operation to rescue our hostages in Tehran, Iran.
Okay.
Yeah, in 79. And so, anyway, when he got back from Vietnam, he had went to Dade County, Florida, and worked. He was the head of No-Narcotics. And so he worked with Janet Reno down there. She was the district attorney in Dade County.
Oh, wow.
He knew her real good, and he told me all kinds of stuff about her, like, you know, they would be coke busts and evidence in the evidence room. They'd been out all night, and they hit meth labs and coke labs and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And they'd bring the evidence back there, and he eyewitnessed her on several times. He told me she would take, you know, drugs out of the stuff and then use it for her lesbian buddies. And he eyewitnessed her. She told him on several politically sensitive cases to destroy the evidence and let the people go. And so he knew she was dirty, and then after Hubble, who Bill Clinton, when he was first president, he appointed him as the AG, the Attorney General.
Oh, yeah.
Hubble got indicted on state charges down there in Arkansas, and then Janet Reno was pegged to move up to the United States Attorney General. So she and Bill Clinton were there in Denver after the Columbine shooting, and when Clinton was president, he fired every U.S. attorney.
Uh-huh.
He's the first to ever do it, and then he put his own guys in. One of the guys he put in was Tom Strickland, a Democrat up in the Denver area. And Tom Strickland had been with a law firm, Hyatt, Fayette, Brownstein, Norman Brownstein, and Faber. And that was our law firm. And we found out later that Norman Brownstein, he was the principal of the law firm in Denver, but back in the 70s, when George Bush Sr. was DCI, Director of Central Intelligence, Brownstein was on the Council of Six for the CIA. That's a Council of Six attorneys that handles, basically blowback from the IG's office, the Inspector General's office. I've had people from the IG's office right here in my house for dinner. But anyway, so the fix was in up in the Tenth Circuit. That's why they sent McVeigh and Nichols up to the Tenth Circuit for the trial. They controlled it. Judge Nottingham was nominated by a CIA director. The prosecutor, chief prosecutor, United States attorney for the Tenth Circuit, Tom Strickland, was appointed directly by Bill Clinton. Okay? So the fix was in on the Tenth Circuit. And the whole story is in this book, how that denied my bond. I had a perfect record with no traffic tickets at all. And the judge said no bond under any conditions. And they put me in supermax solitary confinement a few cells down when Tim McVeigh was there.
Oh,
and
wow.
So then Tim McVeigh was moved later and for his execution, and that execution occurred June 11th, 2001, at the Terre Haute FCI. That's a federal correctional institute, Terre Haute, Indiana. That's where they had built the new death chamber.
Mm-hmm.
So later after that execution, I talked to Nathan Chambers, which was McVeigh's attorney at the time. I talked to him at the FDC, the Federal Detention Center, in Inglewood, Colorado, and asked him about that, execution. And so, anyway, to make a long story short, I hope I'm not jumping around in time too much.
No, man, I love it. I wish I had some notepads. I'd be taking notes of this, thankfully.
Okay. Well, all this is in the book. It's detailed highly. But anyway, so I had been sitting in there with my bond denied. In there was a guy named Kerry Gagin, Kerry James Gagin.
Okay.
And Gagin had been given a van load of C4 plastic explosives. He was also a CIA asset. A whole van load of plastic explosives in Denver, Colorado, 3 days before the Murrah Building went up. That was April 16th of 1995. He was supposed to meet his contacts in Trinidad, Colorado. He drove the C4 down there, and there were three Middle Eastern men he met. And they had plans to the Alfred P. Murrah Building in English. And he saw them. And he got weird. He came back up. He thought he was going to be set up. He thought something weird was going on. He went to the Secret Service office in Denver and told them about it. But the agency, CIA, had them bugged and infiltrated like they do most everything. And so they planted him with false evidence, just like they did me.
Mm-hmm.
And they put him in there with us at the 10th Circuit there. And so I talked to him, and he showed me a bunch of his stuff. And then one day they came and got him and disappeared him. I don't know what happened to him. And then McVeigh was executed, and Terry Nichols got life without parole. He's down here at the the Federal Correctional Institute, Supermax, in Florence, Colorado.
Huh.
Yeah, he's down there with Aldrich Ames. He was our CI station in Moscow, and he got turned by the KGB over there and then came back here and was caught for espionage. Also, there's some other people, you know, that were Robert Hansen's another one, the 26-year FBI counterintelligence guy that the KGB also turned, and he got caught, and they're all down there together. So Nichols got, I think, life without parole or 99 years or something like that. But anyway, I was sitting up there. Gagin was gone. Nichols was gone. McVeigh was gone. I was the last one left. And I got a bond finally after about almost 2 years of sitting there. Remember, I got planted with false evidence, something I didn't do. We can tell that whole story, too.
Yeah, it seems to be the MO for all things FBI and CIA.
Right, and that's how they shut whistleblowers or witnesses up, you know. And what they did to me was, when I got out, we hired a tape expert named William Valentine. And William Valentine had worked for the CIA before. He's an electronics genius. And his previous job had been to bug and debug the White House. Okay, he had coffee with three sitting presidents, Reagan, Bush, and Clinton. And his job was to sweep, you know, for bugs. You know, after that thing with Nixon, you remember all that with the Watergate tapes?
Mm-hmm.
They played the tapes of Nixon inside the White House, and it was a bad thing. Well, all the presidents after that were real leery about that. And they were really high on making sure nobody heard their personal conversations. You see what I'm saying?
It would be nice to have privacy again.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So anyway, Valentine, we hired him. And we came up with 100% legal proof that the ATF and the DEA had doctored the tapes. We knew that the CIA had disappeared the tapes. Okay. I had went over to that undercover residence 2 days after the Columbine shooting. That was April 20th, 99. And on April 22nd, I told Blake Butler about all those CIA ops and the Clintons and the cocaine in Arkansas and the arms and all that stuff. And, well, the CIA disappeared the tapes and they planted me with evidence. So you fast forward through this time, and we hired this tape expert. We had 100% legal proof that the ATF and the DEA were involved in planting evidence, tampering with evidence, lying to the grand jury, committing perjury to the grand jury, perjury to the magistrate judge, perjury to the district judge in the 10th Circuit, and that they were all involved in conspiracies to obstruct justice. And Valentine told me, he had forensic tape proof that the tapes had been cut and all this illegal stuff was done. And he told me, he said, they're never going to let you get this in the court. They're going to kill you. These guys were at Waco. They burned all those people. These guys were at Ruby Ridge where, you know, Vicki Weaver was shot holding a baby. They shot her in the neck. It's all documented. These guys were in Oklahoma City where 168 people died, you know. He said, these guys are murderers and killers. And he said, if you ever get this into court, and it's going to make the front page of every newspaper in the U.S. and all the you'll be at the very first show on ABC News and NBC. He said, but they're all going to prison. He said, you better be real careful. Well, we tried to get this stuff into court. And Judge Nottingham, he said, on July 24th of 2003, he said, we will have a final motion hearing. John, I went 4 years and never even had a motion hearing. Oh, yeah, they violated every procedural rule. When we had hearings, they kicked the U.S. Marshals out and the transcribers. And they had what they called in-camera reviews. The CIA was there, and there were no witnesses or anything. It was all sealed up. But anyway, on July 24th of 2003, Judge Nottingham said, we're going to have this final motions hearing where we get all this stuff into court. Well, on July the 7th, John, 2003, I went to the Walmart parking lot on 8th Street in Colorado Springs. I was cleaning the windshield on my LTD Crown Victoria. My wife was in there shopping.
Okay.
And I never heard it. I never saw it. The parking space in front of the LTE was empty. And I heard a motor revving and tire squealing. And while I was leaned across the hood of my LTE cleaning the windshield, the car was totaled out from under me in the parking lot. And it was, the motor was off, parking brake set. It knocked the car back about 6 or 8 feet. It knocked me back up, and I landed on the roof of the car beside us. I rolled over the hood, bounced off the fender well of another car, and then hit a concrete light pole.
Jeez.
And it almost killed me. And so I went to the hospital. I was in the hospital for a while. I finally got out, and then I was in an outpatient physical therapy unit in Colorado Springs, and I was walking with a cane. And I was walking out of that therapy deal to my other car, and I looked on the street behind it, and there was a Colorado Springs police cruiser with a motor running sitting there. And so I got around by my car while I floored the motor and jumped the curb. There were sparks flying everywhere, and this thing came right at me. And at the last second, I thought they were going to crush me between these two cars. At the last second, that car turned sideways and threw dirt and gravel and stuff all over me. And sitting inside that car was ATF agent Blake Butler.
Good
dressed
grief.
In a Colorado Springs police uniform. Now, he had been awarded the nation's top cop award by Vice President Al Gore and the previously mentioned Janet Reno, the United States Attorney General, at a dinner party in D.C. I have all this in the book. I got pictures of it and everything. So Blake Butler looked at me. You got to remember, this is 2 weeks before this big hearing where we're going to take down the ATF and the DEA office right here in Colorado. And he had glasses on and a Colorado Springs police uniform, no bulletproof vest, and they're required always, you know, to wear the duty vest. But he shook his finger at me. He was only about 3 or 4 feet away. And, you know, like, don't go to court. Well, I drove back home to my mountain home up here, and I stopped and threw up on the way. I was upset.
I can't imagine.
And I got home, and so we were sitting here watching a movie with my wife and young son, and somebody pulled us a remote cabin way out. You know, we're 4 feet to the National Forest here, John, way out in the middle of nowhere. And so someone pulled up in the front yard. It was an SUV. And I figured they were just going to kill me. And I didn't want my son to see his dad shot, so I just went down there unarmed. And I walked around the corner of the back of the car, and he rolled the window down, and sitting in the car with the motor running was Harold Leonard, the guy that had offered me the job to bomb the Alfred P. Murray Federal Building back in October of 1994 for $1 million in cash.
Man.
And he looked at me. And he said, if you ever go to court or you talk about the Murray Building, you talk about any of the stuff we did, because we did other ops besides the Murray Building, but he said, if you talk about any of this, he said, we've got orders to kill you. And then he pointed up here to my house.
Mm-hmm.
And we got orders to kill your family. And he was giving me a heads up.
And this guy's a contractor too, right?
Well, yeah, he was my friend. He was my op buddy.
Jesus,
man. Anyway, he put his head, he had both his hands on the steering wheel. And he put his head down on it and took a deep breath and then pulled up and looked at me. And he goes, it's nothing personal.
Good grief.
And so, I'm almost done with this story. It's all detailed in the book, dates, names, times, everything.
Sure.
So this is 2 weeks before this big hearing where we had proof to 100% legal standard of all these crimes that the ATF and the DEA committed, not to mention the CIA stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's 2 weeks before this big hearing, and I came in here and called my attorney, Harvey Steinberg. He was the Denver Broncos football team attorney up there at the time. And I said, look, I'm going to change my plea. So we went up to Denver, and we found Greg Goldberg, who was the United States assistant attorney who had taken over the case from USAG Guy Till. And, and he was walking out of a case, and he had his arms full of documents. And Harvey told him, he said, look, he wants to change his plea. And he goes, oh, yeah, I've heard about this. I'm getting a lot of heat about this case. I don't know what's going on with it. I don't want to know what's going on with it. Just plead guilty to something, and you're out of here. So I pointed to something on the indictment that it was upside down. I didn't even know what it was, and I didn't care. And it was stealing firearms without a license. And it's a really minor thing, class 4 felony, mm-hmm. because I'd been the biggest, largest machine gun dealer here in the state of Colorado. I had a 1,800-square-foot machine gun shop. We had class 1, class 2, and class 3 NFA, that's National Firearms Act. Right? You know, we had blueing tanks, lathes. We could build machine guns, build silencers. You know, we had a big business. We did stuff with DEA, FBI, the local cops, everything. So anyway, I said, yeah, I'll plead guilty to whatever you want. I don't care. And that got the CIA and it got the ATF and the DEA off of me. I made up my mind, you know, that if I could ever, if the Clintons would ever get out of office, you know, Bill was president for a while, and then Hillary was Secretary of State. And when she lost the election to Donald Trump, I made up my mind I was going to break the story. And so we broke the story. I had the book already written, and I was hiding it. I didn't take it to any publishers because I knew if I stuck it out, the CIA would either whack me or make sure it never got to the light of day.
Mm-hmm.
And so Ole Domagard helped me break the story. And our plan was to do 5, 6, 7 interviews a day and get as much exposure in the media as I could, because the more exposure I get, the more protected I'd be.
Absolutely.
And so we did it, and we've sold, I have no idea how many thousands of these books all around the world. We got a big group over in Europe that likes all this stuff. And so here in the States, we got hit with tremendous censorship. I'm on my third set of computers. They sent us weaponized viruses. They mess with almost everything we did, the Stripes, the Sprint, PayPal. We start selling books like crazy, and then they'd hit it and shut it down, and then we fix it, get it back up, start selling books again, and they'd hit it again, and it goes on and on and on. So they've done what they could to shut this up. And also then on December 21st of 2017, I was struck in a head-on collision in a car, nearly killed again. It was a hit. It was a straight-up hit. Okay. I had a severe concussion and asymmetric whiplash. I'm still going to doctors and therapies, and that was in 2017. And so I'm writing a new book now called Holding the Light, Spiritual Forces in the Black Ops.
Mm-hmm.
And it's telling stories about how they use car wrecks and accidents, how they use directed energy weapons to simulate microwave, microwave attacks to simulate heart attacks and strokes, by heating up the capillaries and bursting them in your brain with brain aneurysms, and all the different hit techniques they use with, poisons and protein synthesized poisons and so forth. And, you know, Saddam Hussein over there, getting back to him, his secret police, that was one of his favorite tactics, was to summon people to Baghdad, you know, to, meet with them and all, and then they would have a car accident.
Mm-hmm.
Clintons have done a few of that, too, and we have that detailed here in the book. So I know I'm jumping around. There's a lot of stuff to the story, but my basic story was I was with the nation's top cop for 2 years. He was at the Alfred P. Murrah Building the day it was bombed and called in sick, wasn't there. He was at Ruby Ridge. He was at Waco. And everywhere the guy's been, there's been people murdered. There's been allegations of cover-up made. And the shadow government, this corrupt legal system, covers it up. The agents can basically get away with whatever they want. And then the rest of us people, you know, we get held accountable for no seatbelt and spitting on the sidewalk. And one reason, John, we wrote this book, and we're trying to get the American people to wake up to how corrupt their justice system really is, because the corruption is mostly hidden. And in this book, I have proof. I have stuff. We even snuck tape recording. I snuck surveillance equipment inside the United States Attorney's Office through all their x-ray machines and all their security, and I tape recorded them inside there. And I got them on tape asking me, you know, the nation's top cop, did you ever work for the CIA and all this stuff? Meanwhile, CIA agents were sitting in there. And so we have a lot of evidence. We've got over 20,000 pages of discovery documents. We have VHS surveillance tapes. Also, me and some Army Ranger guys, we snuck around and we did our own counter surveillance.
Yeah.
Of the ATF and DEA surveillance. So we have our own counter surveillance pictures. We have a lot of stuff in this book. It's a real juicy story, and the problem with it all is that it's true.
That's what's so startling, I think, to the general public. And I hope that a lot of people get this message that maybe have forgotten the 90s stuff, or like we talked about before, a lot of millennials, because this is so key. I mean, I think a lot of people live in the reality that they believe to be real. And if you look at this vellum that you're talking about here, there's a whole other world that most of the general public doesn't even grasp. I mean, it's so, to me at least, it's so, even having known most of this information, not from your perspective, but from other things, you know, I mean, even to me, it's still jarring, and I think it should be jarring to the people. I mean, it's...
Yeah, well, some people have called the 1990s the darkest of times here in America, and that's when Bill Clinton was there.
Mm-hmm.
Bill and Hillary Clinton are monsters. They're not, you know, they have a real polished image, and they've got the press behind them. They worked for the CIA back in Arkansas. The whole story's in the book. I mean, I could talk 2 more hours about all the ops we were in. I was in the op, Centaur Rose down there.
Hmm.
And as you recall, John, that was, you know, just a basic overview. Let's see, back in February of 1984, I believe it was, Congress passed the Boland Amendment.
Okay.
And as you recall, the Nicaraguan situation was going on with Daniel Ortega.
Mm-hmm.
Some of my friends had dinner with him in his palace. Also, some of my associates had friends with had dinner with Muammar Gaddafi over in Libya, Tripoli, Libya.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a lot of intel and people. You know, also some of my associates met Bill and Hillary Clinton personally and worked on their stuff. So we have a lot of firsthand and secondhand information. But this whole thing with the Boland Amendment, the Russians were down there supplying the Sandinistas with Ortega, and then, of course, we had the Contras, and we were Reagan wanted to help them. But the Boland Amendment forbade us from putting troops down there, so Reagan went around the CIA and ordered DCI, Director of Central Intelligence, to create operations to assist the Contras. And the one I was in was Centaur Rose. That was a code name for it. Rose for Rose Law Firm.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. And then what we did was we get stuff out of the armories. We had contacts inside the National Guard armories. And, you know, back in the 80s, John, they didn't have anything quite on these big computer things like they do now. And you could change a 1, you know, a 10 to a 1 pretty easy on a ledger.
Oh, yeah.
So some things, you know, we would say they would fall off the truck, you know, cases of hand grenades and C4, Comp B, Composition B, and so forth.
Oh, man, that's a lot.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So anyway, that was going down there to help them. And Centaur Rose was an arms and drug op. The arms were going down to supply the Contras.
And was this coming out of bases in Arkansas or other places in the country?
Well, one of the places that, you know, they had that Robinson National Guard Armory in Little Rock. There's two Little Rock National Guard Armories there. And I can't. You know, I know all the names, all the kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah, it's all right. We don't have to talk about anything.
Under the 1982 Intelligence Identities Protection Act, that's the IIPA. You know, that's U.S. Code Title 50, Sections 421, 426. And you're forbidden, you know, to, you know, state the identity.
Oh, yeah, understood.
Yeah, so some of these guys, a few of them are still alive. They got family and, you know, so forth. So I don't use their names. But
absolutely.
Guys like that. Lynn Wilson and Duke Flagbeard, my handlers in the NCI, they're dead now of Agent Orange. Both of them died of Agent Orange, so we can use their names because they're dead. But anyway, yeah, there were armories down there. There was another op called Screwworm, which was a parallel op out of Mexico City, which was a manufacturing op where they just build machine gun receivers and so forth, and then they would create guns, build them, and then, you know, turn them over to the Contras to help arm them. The Russians were arming with AK-47s and RPGs and everything for Ortega. And Reagan didn't want the balance of power to change. He was afraid, just like in Vietnam, you know, with the domino effect.
Yeah.
If the Russians were allowed to fund and arm a guy like Ortega, you know, they could take over Nicaragua, then what would be next? El Salvador, up to Mexico, and so forth, right to our border.
Yeah.
And Congress forbade him, kind of tied his hands. So Reagan said, you know, you guys can go straight to, you know, where.
Oh, yeah.
And we're going to create these ops. There was three of them. Screwworm, Jade Bridge, and Centaur Rose. Jade Bridge was an op where they brought the Contra pilots, guys that were being trained on light aircraft, single engine aircraft, around the Ouachita National Forest there, around MENA. And then they would train them and send them back down. And then Screwworm was a weapons op in Metro City. And then Centaur Rose, the one I was in, was there. So all this detail in the book. And anyway, they were turning about $100 million a month in cocaine. That's how they paid for the black ops. And they were bringing the ops, the stuff back up, and then it was spread here to the U.S. The whole story of how it's all done is here in the book.
Yeah,
so Clinton was running front for the CIA, using his position as governor, okay? And Hillary Clinton was working in the Rose Law Firm with Hubble and all those guys, and then they would help wash the money. And they washed the money through scandals like the Whitewater with Jim and Susan McDougal in the Bank of Rock.
Yeah, I think they had a beef scandal or something, too, I believe. I can't recall.
Yeah. They, you know, that's a lot of money to wash, and they washed it through that and went through the Worthington Bank, some of it. Bill Clinton created the ADFA. We talked about that in the book, Arkansas Development and Finance, and he sold it to the people of the state of Arkansas as a way to take federal highway money and education money and mix it with the state money, the taxes, and then make it better for the people in Arkansas. And what it really was a massive money laundering scheme. And then later that would morph into what the Clinton Foundation is. You know, the Clintons are masters, absolute masters, at laundering money and doing black ops. And they've got the support of the CIA and the shadow government. And so there's so much in this book. They've been involved in drugs, sex rings. They're absolutely some of the best criminals America ever produced. You know, Bonnie and Clyde were a man-woman team, American history, a criminal team. I hope one day that the truth will come out about the Clintons and all the stuff they've done, because we saw a lot of it firsthand. But we were black operators and shut our mouths for a long time. But I'm hoping this will all come out one day. And when it does, you know, they'll be the premier criminal man and wife team ever that America's ever produced.
Yeah, you can say that again. They make Al Capone and Bugsy Siegel look like small potatoes.
Oh, sure. Yeah, so anyway, all these ops are there. There's a lot of stuff in this book. I know I'm jumping around.
No, I love it, man. I'm fascinated.
Well, Barry Seal, you know, he was in the 20th Special Forces Group. 1963, Fort Benning or Fort Bragg, I can't remember which one, but
yeah, that's what I was going to ask you about. It seems to me like there's a whole lot of connections between, if you want to go all the way back to Lee Harvey Oswald and Timothy McVeigh and Barry Seal, there always seems to be a military connection.
There
and
is.
Nine times out of ten, there seems to be one with the base a couple hours north of me, Fort Bragg, where they got the MARSOC, they got Spec Ops, they got the Psych Op divisions, I mean.
Oh, yeah, you're absolutely right.
There's a lot close to me, which kind of scares me, to be honest with you.
Right. In this book, I have all the research and stuff on all these guys. I can't remember all these dates and times off of the top of my head. I wrote this book years ago.
Oh, absolutely.
And I'm trying to give you a basic overview, but you're absolutely right. Barry Seal and them went to over to Vietnam. He was a pilot. In,
one of the best from everything I've read, like a phenomenal.
Oh, sure. Duke Flaglier, he was in the SF, Special Forces, and then, of course, Barry Sadler, Staff Sergeant. You know, he stepped on a punji stick and played coup in the Highlands, and I think it was 65. Then they sent him down to that Subic Bay Medical Facility. He had a real bad infection, almost lost his leg, and that's where he wrote that song, The Battle of the Green Beret.
Okay.
Yeah, the older generation, you know, can remember this stuff. A lot of the millennials and kids today never heard of it, but it was the number one hit single in 1965 here in the States, Battle of the Green Beret. And so later on, I was offered the job to bodyguard Barry Sadler down in Guatemala. They were working with G2 Intelligence, and Barry Sadler had been working some with the agency. And the whole story's in the book, the truth of what really happened. He was assassinated down there. Or shot. And the whole story of what really happened down there. He got shot 2 weeks before I was to be redeployed down there to bodyguarding. Because I did martial arts for over 20 years, went to Japan and studied. I had a real high-level training. And then I was also offered the job to be the hand-to-hand combat instructor for the Contras down there in Nicaragua. But I was way too busy up here to, you know, mess with stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I was using Amoco Production Company. I was a petroleum geophysicist there after working with Chevron after graduate school. That was my civilian front for operations over in Arkansas. In 82, 83, 84, 85, we were all involved in those ops there. So this is all detailed in the book. And then after they cleaned up the op, you know, Barry Steele was a contract pilot. After they got out of Vietnam, he set up a thing called Rich Mountain Aviation. It was a civilian front airplane deal, a pilot deal at the Mena Airport. And a C-123 called the Fat Lady, they would take all the arms that we got out of the States here. And there was other teams working, not just us, but they would take all the arms down there and fly them down there and then bring drugs back. And so, you know, he was a really good pilot, but later on, like the rest of us, they planted him with evidence, and they put him in a DEA halfway house there. It was a federal halfway house in Baton Rouge. And on February 19th of 86, this is way after all the ops at Mena and everything, they do their standard cleanup. You know, they either kill out the people or put them in prison and shut them up. And February 19th of 86, four Colombian hitmen walked up to his halfway house. He was working outside in a civilian job and then coming back to the federal halfway house at night. So he pulled up in the parking lot late in the afternoon, and they just walked up with 9mm MAC-10s and hosed him down. No ski mask, no black gloves, nothing. And that same day, John, down in Colombia, this is February 19th of 86, there were 25 to 30 different cartel guys all hit, all murdered the same way. One of them was Pablo Carrera, the number two Medellin cartel guy, and another one was Jorge Ochoa, you know, the Ochoa brothers, the big coke rings. And so that story's in the book. When he opened the trunk of his car, he had a coat in there. In the pocket of the coat was George Bush Sr.'s personal cell phone number. Then later on, one of the aircraft that was at the Rich Mountain Aviation Facility there in Mena, Arkansas, that was a 1982 Beechcraft King Air 200. That was one of the SEAL's personal planes, you know. And that, guess where that was found, John? It was found at the Crawford Ranch.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah, and the guy that broke the story, the serial number on that plane, I believe, is BB1014, something like that. I've got it all in the book. Sure. I can't remember all this stuff, but I need some coffee anyway. This is my third interview today, so I'm kind of...
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, but the story was broke by ex-LAPD narcotics officer Michael Rupert.
Oh, yeah, I remember him.
Well, he was a good friend of mine. He's been here at the house several times. And we also knew the guy that, you know, Kramer, the guy that trained him in LAPD when he first came in. And so Rupert's told me quite a bit of stuff about all of the, how the CIA had infiltrated the LAPD and the whole thing. I mean, there is so much here. But anyway, Barry Steele, they found his plane there at George Bush Jr.'s ranch. They didn't change the numbers. This is how blatant these high-level criminals are.
So his plane disappeared, ends up in the Bush ranch.
The Bush and the Clintons were all involved together in these CIA ops. And so when George Bush Sr. and Bill Clinton supposedly duked it out in front of the American public,
mm-hmm.
one's a Democrat and one's a Republican. And
oh,
they're
yeah,
fighting
just like WWF.
Exactly. The whole time, John, they're all in it together. And so, like you said, the cross ties with the military, you know, Fort Bragg, Fort Benning, all of this stuff goes way back. Now, one of my girlfriends had dinner with Pablo Escobar one night.
Hmm.
You know, he was the biggest coke dealer in the world.
Yeah.
and it was down in Miami. And it's an interesting story. I get people, some of the radio show hosts, I appreciate you. I'm talking real fast here, and I appreciate you. If you have anything to say, just cut in, because I get to going too fast. I got several stories in this book, side stories.
I love it, man. I'm just trying to get out of your way, so I don't want to interrupt on these stories. My God, I could listen to this.
Yeah, well, one of the stories, you know, you got to remember this thing covers 20 years, so
yeah.
Over. But, anyway, I was doing a show with some host, and they go, wait a minute. You know, your girlfriend had dinner with Pablo Carrera. I said, yeah. So what happened? How did that happen? And I said, well, she was a cocktail waitress at a club down in Miami. I think it was a Carousel Club. And the guy that ran the club, all of this was a front for the drug kingpins, right?
Wow.
And they were dealing large quantities of coke. And she was just a real low-level dealer. I think she was turning, you know, 5 or 6 kilos a week. And it's real low-level stuff. And anyway, one night, the owner of the club said, hey, come out on my boat. You know, we're going to just go have some fun. And so she went out there with him.
Mm-hmm.
This is a story she told me. And she said that, you know, they started drinking and stuff. And so he put the moves on her, and she didn't want to do anything. She's real pretty.
Mm-hmm.
So he tried to rape her. So she got in her purse and got her pistol out and shot him and killed him and threw him overboard. So she's sitting out there offshore in this big jet boat, you know, and she started looking around, looked down in the hold of it, and it was full of cocaine.
Good Lord.
And she got nervous. And so she took the boat back, and she went into the club, and she contacted, you know, some of the owner's friends and said, look, I need to turn this thing in. And so Pablo Escobar was up here from Colombia in the States at that time. He was doing something in Miami. And so the guys that owned the club heard this story. And she said, I killed, you know, the club owner and dumped him overboard, and I got a boatload of coke. So what do you want me to do with it? I don't want to get involved in this. She knew better than to steal a jet boat full of coke from the cartel.
I'm a huge Miami Vice fan, and this makes Miami Vice seem like some very tame.
Well, no, I mean, think about it. I mean,
yeah.
What would you do in that situation? So, anyway, Escobar says, hey, I want to meet this chick, you know? So they set her up, and they went to dinner, and she was sitting there with him having dinner. And he said, so you shot the guy? And she goes, yeah, I threw him overboard. He tried to rape me. And I said, I'm not going to put up with that. And so he had a bag of diamonds. And Escobar dumped these diamonds out in her hand. This is her story, she told me. And he stuck them over there. He said, pick a diamond.
Wow.
She goes, I don't want a diamond. I don't want to do anything. I just want to give you your shit back and get out of here.
Yeah, I don't want to end up in the bottom of the
Atlantic. I don't
want
to end up, yeah. you know how all that goes. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, so he said, look, just pick a diamond. And so she picked a kind of mid-sized one. And he says, okay, I want to offer you a job. I want you to have the job of the guy you killed.
Hmm.
She goes, I don't want a job. I want out. I can't do this.
Yeah.
And she said, why did you offer me the job? And he said, well, this is a standard deal we do. When we dump out a bag of diamonds in my hand, if people pick a big diamond, we know they're greedy. And that they're probably going to steal from the cartel one day, and we'll have to kill them anyway. And if they pick a little diamond, then they're too timid. And they're probably going to turn snitch if they get the pressure on them. So we have to kill them anyway. It's always the people that pick the mid-sized ones, the middle of the road, that are the best workers. And so she said, I don't want anything to do with this. And she got out of there. She sold her house and her boat. She had a bunch of stuff, got rid of it. And then came back up here to Colorado. So that story she told me. But the cartel was everywhere. And I've been through all down there. We were in a lot of ops in Peru and different places. But the cartels are a big thing. There were 25 to 30 of them that were all killed because a lot of the cocaine that was coming back in here to Bill and Hillary Clinton in those ops in Mean, Arkansas with Barry Seale as a pilot. A lot of that was all cartel stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the CIA was controlling the cartels. A lot of people don't know how deep all of this goes. But anyway, that's just one of the stories. You know, we've got a whole bunch of them. And I hope I'm not rambling too much. But
not at all, man. I'm 100% focused on this. Jeez.
Yeah, so if there's any questions, like if you want to talk about Waco or you want to talk about the anthrax vaccines that were made, the anthrax AIM strain at Fort Detrick, we can talk about that going into the Gulf War. We can talk about Ruby Ridge, Waco, whatever. Just I got maybe another 25 minutes to the top of the hour, and I've got a blast.
I feel you, man. Well, I wanted to touch on this before we got away from it, because you mentioned Michael Rupert. And I don't even know if you want to talk about this or don't. It's fine. But what's your take on what happened to him?
Well,
if you don't want to get into it, we don't have to. I'm just,
I will.
It's throwing
good
it
thing.
There.
We need to do this because on Coast to Coast AM, George Norrie had a show, you know, and we just did a show. Oh, gosh. It's been maybe 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
3 weeks ago, where they had several people that knew Mike. And we all did a little testimony because it was like the 5-year anniversary of his suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did a pre-taped show for that station. But, you know, what happened with Michael Rupert? Basically, in a nutshell, we got to go through a little bit of history.
Sure.
He was LAPD. A guy named Lauren Kramer trained him at LAPD. And then I know a whole bunch of, I'm not going to get into all that. But,
sure.
He got in there, and he was doing his job, and there was a lot of corruption, as you might, and your listeners may well know.
Yeah, this was the first police department in the country for a SWAT team, by the way, too. So that sort of gives you the preface here with this rollout of militarization.
Right, and they helped control the Robert Kennedy cover-up of Sirhan Sirhan, too.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, I got a section in the book about that,
Oh, man, I got to get this book.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, this book's got a lot of stuff. I've had a lot of military guys and different people reading. Oh, my God, Cody, that is one heck of a book. That's why it's being censored into the Stone Age, You know, because we didn't send it to the PRB and the CIA, you know, the Publication Review Board.
Yeah, the old censor.
Because we were independent contractors. We didn't sign national security oaths like a lot of the agents. So they don't have any way to control me. By saying, oh, we're throwing you in Leavenworth for violating national security, they just plant you with evidence and throw you in prison and murder you with a car wreck, see?
Hmm.
Okay, now back to Rupert. So Rupert been in there, and there's a lot of corruption. You know, some of those cops would go in and find a kilo of coke and, you know, all kinds of heroin, black tar heroin, lots of money. And it's kind of like the Serpico thing, you know, the movie with Al Pacino where, you know, you got dirty cops and clean cops. Most of them turn in half the coke or half the money, and then they have their street snitches sell the coke for them. So the cops are making money on the side. Okay, that's standard corruption.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, he told me that they would start making busts, and they'd get the street snitches and work their way up to the bigger dealers. And on certain busts, the CIA had an agent inside the LAPD, and they would have to run their bus by them. And it turned out that the CIA agent knew what was really CIA drugs and what was other stuff. And so he would always wave them off and tell the LAPD narcotics guys, don't bust these guys. You know, They're our guys. So Rupert later, he saw all the corruption, and he went to blow the whistle. And I believe the YouTube video is still up. People can Google this up right now, tonight, right, and look at it. He confronted the CIA director, I think it was John Deutsch at the time, at a public LA meeting. It was a town hall meeting thing. And Rupert's on video accusing the CIA of dealing drugs, bringing them in the country through the Nicaraguans, and we're covering it all up. And using the LAPD to cover it up.
I'm pretty sure that put a big target on his head.
Oh, yeah. He picked Operation Amethyst, I think was one of them. There was another one, Operation Pegasus. I think Chip Tatum was in that. That was a separate op, I think. But anyway, so they can look at this YouTube video. It's still up, I think. And he's on tape, standing there confronting them. Well, then later, you know, he got out of the LAPD, and then he started that I think it was Owl of the Wilderness. It was a newsletter up in Seattle area. They broke in there. They planted him with a honeypot. He sent me pictures.
Jeez.
They broke in at night and trashed his hard drives and tore everything up and threatened him and so forth. He went down to South America for a while, came back up to the States. They tried to poison him down there, and he came back up here, and I helped him do a lot of stuff here. But anyway, fast forward, Michael Rupert had been an alcoholic in the LAPD, you know, those guys had seen a lot of ugly stuff.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine.
Babies in the microwave, you know, kids in the dryer that dead, you know, crack dealers, prostitutes. He got shot once, stabbed one. You know, it's nasty,
mm-hmm.
ugly business. And he started drinking. He told me that he wanted to get his 20-year retirement and his benefits and everything. And he would just come home at night and get a fresh bottle and drink, you know, and pass out and then get up in the morning. And that's how he got through his last, you know, years and days. And then he got into AA and everything. Well, after all this stuff happened to him, he came back up here to Colorado, Crestone, Colorado, and he's living with a guy, Doug Lewis. And I stayed there. He stayed here some, and he's a good friend. Well, a lot of people, John, said that since he confronted the CIA director about all their illegal drug dealing in L.A. and everything, that the agency waited and had him murdered.
Hmm.
And so when Mike Rupert committed suicide, so when they found his body in Sebastopol, California, the gist was all over the internet, of course, John. You know how they do it. Oh, my God, it's a conspiracy, you know. They murdered him and made it look like a suicide and all.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so he had a Glock 40 pistol, which I had in my hands, the same gun, you know, and he had an eagle feather I'd given him because we've been doing a lot of healing. He had seen a lot of ugly stuff, and we've been doing healings on him, and he had that eagle feather in his left hand and the Glock 40 in his right hand. He sat down and put it in his mouth and pulled the trigger. Now, I had talked to Mike about 6 hours before this suicide. I called him from here in Colorado, and we talked about 10 or 15 minutes on the phone, and he gave no warning at all. He didn't even mention it. But he had talked about suicide several times, so he did commit suicide. It wasn't a CIA hit or any of that stuff. But that's what happened to Michael Rupert, and he had seen enough. He wrote those books. He gave me several copies of the books that he wrote. One of them was Crossing the Rubicon.
Mm-hmm.
That was a book, and they had him on Coast to Coast. He did a shows on that, and he had a big following on Facebook and so forth. But, you know, he told me a lot of stories about LAPD and about the corruption and the CIA and all that kind of stuff. And his dad was a general.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, there's a lot of stuff to all this. But
wow.
We never went public right when Mike... There's a lot of stuff I'm not talking about right now that's kind of
totally
ugly.
Understand.
And we decided when he died that we didn't want to tarnish, you know, his reputation.
Mm-hmm.
Because when they did the show on Coast to Coast with George Norrie, they... you know, they were talking about his accomplishments and all the good things. He did a lot of good things, and he faced a mile of crap when he went public. Can you imagine going up against the CIA director in public on tape and accusing him of being a drug dealer? If you don't believe me, watch that video.
Oh, I've seen it. That takes some huevos.
Yeah, buddy. So our hats went off to him, and, you know, the other stuff we know, the personal stuff, me and Doug, his roommate, we decided not to make it public.
Sure.
Because somebody told me, Cody, you ought to get on that show on Coast to Coast, and I didn't want to do that. So we just let them all yap and let them, all these armchair quarterback guys, talk their stuff. But we know the real deal. I mean, I talked to him just 6 hours before he died, and he was here, like I said, he stayed here at my house
mm-hmm.
several times and stuff, so... we were good friends, and that's the story about Rupert. He was a good guy. He was a truth seeker, truth warrior. And our hats go off to all the people like Philip Marshall.
That's another one right there, yeah.
Yeah, Michael Hastings.
Yeah.
Vince Foster. You know, in the book here, we have a section about the Clinton death list.
Yeah.
and how, you know, heart attack, stroke, standard CI thing.
Gary Webb. We forgot a Gary, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There's so much here. I mean, we're jumping around through several decades. We're jumping around through several stories. So I've got so much information and so much stuff, I could talk another 3 hours. Now listen to this, John. There's one more thing I want to close off with.
Please.
Here. Remember I told you, you know, how the story of how Judge Nottingham said there'd be a final hearing, and then I got hit in the car, almost killed in the Walmart parking lot. Then I almost got crushed again, you know, threatening me with the police cruiser. And then finally how Harold Leonard came up here and told me they're going to murder my family right in my front yard, by the way. And I pleaded guilty to something I didn't do. It was all BS. But anyway, it got them off of me, and I stayed alive. Okay, later on, Judge Edward Nottingham, the chief judge in the 10th Circuit, the one that was appointed by Director Central Intelligence, not appointed, excuse me, nominated.
Gotcha.
By Director Central Intelligence, George Bush Sr., Judge Edward Nottingham, in 2007, had to resign in a sex scandal with prostitutes.
Wow.
The federal judge. He was corrupt beyond measure. The story's in here in the book.
Mm-hmm.
He was a Denver Players owner. That was a club. And Brenda Stewart was the owner. And she testified about the stuff he'd done. We have articles from Nine News and all the stuff in here about Nottingham getting drunk and buying hookers and the whole thing.
Yeah.
And so not only was he a cover-up artist for the CIA and all cases that dealt with national security for CIA or NSA were steered to Judge Nottingham. The DOJ, Department of Justice, had something called the Promise software. We have a section in the book about it. It's software designed inside the DOJ to take sensitive cases and steer them to judges that the CIA had placed in there. And that's how they cover up and how none of this stuff ever makes the light of day.
Wow.
And so it's the corruption inside our federal court systems is far, far deeper than most people realize. We have sections in here of how they rigged the jury wheels and they placed undercover agents and duplexed the identities of legitimate jurors and substituted undercover federal agents for the actual jurors so they could throw the cases. Like Al Capone paying the judge or the, you know, the jurors off.
Sure.
Same kind of thing. And it's all in here. The corruption, not only, you know, with the CIA and all of it, and with the drugs, LAPD, New York Police Department with 9/11, the whole thing. There is so, the corruption here is absolutely astounding. And it's swept under the rug and covered up, and then the witnesses are murdered like Vince Foster or whoever, and it never makes the light of day. And most Americans are fed a steady stream of absolute propaganda, strategic deception. You know, the media is just psyops. And so they've been lied to about 9/11. They've been lied to about the Murrah Building, Oklahoma City. They've been lied to about Ruby Ridge.
That's it.
They've been lied to about Vietnam, all the China white hair. And you're talking about the guys from Fort Bragg.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that William P. Barr, our new attorney general, he was actually CIA agent Robert Johnson. And he was down there at that Robinson Little Rock National Guard armory bunker and met with Bill Clinton and John Clancy, who was all over North, and Max Gomez, who was also Felix Rodriguez, CIA agent Felix Rodriguez, that was in the Operation 40 stuff with General Richard Secord, and CIA agent Ted Shackley, all in the Air America stuff in Vietnam. You know how they were moving all the China white heroin.
Yeah, and the corpses of the soldiers.
Sure. And then later on, Secord and Shackley went to Costa Rica after NAM was over. I got offered jobs to help move a bunch of the arms out of there. That's a whole other story. We're going to put that in the next book. I've got a whole bunch of stories. This book was 1,200 pages when I wrote it, and we had to chop it down, so we got it down to 700, and it's still way too big. But I've just got to write a series of more books, you know, to get the stuff out if I can stay alive long enough. So, yeah, all this is tied together, just like you said, through the military. A lot of these guys get trained in the military, like Timothy McVeigh.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, they're used as ex-military cutouts or assets. They're recruited by the CIA. The story's in this book here, how Tim McVeigh, when he got back from Desert Storm, he was at Waco the night that all that happened. I got the whole story about all that, what really happened at Waco, from people that talked to Kresh on the phone just after he got shot, just before the feds cut the phone line and everything.
Yeah.
We got the real skinny here. But, yeah, it's too much for now. But
absolutely.
Maybe in the future, if you want to, we can do a show about some of that. But I know I'm jumping around in time here and jumping around. There's so much. We can drill down in Waco and talk an hour and a half.
Yeah, wow.
And the Murrow Building, what really happened there with Dr. John Chumley, Terry Yeakey, the Canadian County Deputy Sheriff Mike Ramsey, FBI, SAC, you know, Strategic Area Commander Bob Ricks out of the Oklahoma City building, the black helicopters, you know, the whole thing. There's so much here. So,
yeah, we definitely have to do this again. I've told this before. I feel like the 90s are somehow like this vortex of forgotten history. Everybody loves to talk about JFK and the Vietnam era stuff. And then when you get to Reagan, it gets kind of, everything was great. And then the 90s is just sort of like this vortex of history where everybody, well, I won't say everyone because me and you are obviously speaking, but, you know, I guess a lot of people are just either numb to it or don't know it or don't want to know it. I don't know, but.
Well, some people don't care, and, you know, like I said, the millennial, younger people, a lot of them in the Q phenomenon, and they're with current events now, but this stuff's ancient history to them. But I was alive through this and lived through a lot of it, and we were in ops in some of it. We know a whole lot about some things and very little about other things. But this story here in the book is how I talked in an undercover location. I did not know they had their little 4mm hidden cameras. And I yapped my mouth about real live CIA ops. And, you know, Bill Clinton had been promoted up to president and all. Then the Clintons used their power to get the CIA and the ATF to bury me and throw me in prison and plant me with false evidence. I'd like to close. We got just a few minutes
sure.
here. But I'd like to tell the story of how they planted me with false evidence. This will really make your stomach turn. Okay, well, this is detailed in the book. I have copies of my federal licenses and all my crap. Scientific Systems was the name of my machine gun business here in Colorado. I was the number one dealer here in the state. We dealt all around the country. We had Class 1, Class 2, and Class 3 licenses. So, okay, so in Operation Stingray from 97 to 99, that was ATF DEA Operation Stingray, Blake Butler was trying to buy guns from me, and I sold him some legal guns. Everything was legal.
Okay.
He kept trying to get me to do illegal stuff, and I wouldn't do it.
Trying to set you up like Randy Weaver again.
Exactly, same kind of thing. He's trying to entrap you.
Yeah.
So we're sitting at the house, and they had these 4mm hidden cameras, or two of them. And I took a Steyr AUG gun over there. Do you know what that is?
I do not.
Let me for your readers, your listeners, let me tell you what it is. A Steyr AUG is a 223 bullpup design military weapon.
Okay.
It's made in Austria for their troops over there. And it has an internal select switch on the full auto version. Now, they made them for their troops. But they were so popular and such high quality weapons, they made a sporter version, which is semi-automatic, and they made it for export to the U.S. market, which is a big market. So they started selling them over here. And I had a Styrog, which was a legal semi-automatic weapon. And then here in the United States, they had machine gun trigger packs. And you could have the machine gun trigger packs for the Star and then the semi-automatic Star, and everything was legal because we used to sell them at the gun shows.
Gotcha, yeah.
But if you take the full auto trigger pack and put it in the gun without registering it and getting a $200 tax stamp,
mm-hmm.
it's a felony.
Gotcha.
So we were sitting there in his living room under these cameras, and I had that gun and the two trigger packs laying on the table. And he kept saying, come on, man, show me how to put that together. And I said, no, I'm not going to do that. Finally, after about the third time, he kept pestering me. Finally, I got mad at him, and I yelled at him. And I said, no, that's a felony, and I won't do it.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to take that stuff and do it, that's your business. So he bought the stuff. They took it down to the ATF office, and they converted it to an illegal machine gun. Then they charged me with it and went back to the tapes, and they cut the part out where I said, no, that's a felony. I won't do it, and spliced the tapes back together. Then they took the tampered with evidence, the illegal evidence that they tampered with, and took it in front of the grand jury and lied to them. Then they got an indictment and indicted me.
Jeez.
And that's when we hired the tape expert, William Valentine, and we had proof that they'd cut the tapes. That's a felony to tamper with evidence.
That's like the missing Zapruder film tape segment,
exactly.
The missing Deep Throat tape segment. This seems to be their MO.
And then while I talked about CIA operations and the pedophile rings in Arkansas, because I met Kathy O'Brien, the CIA sex slave, you know, the mind control, the MK Ultra monarch.
Yeah.
I talked to her, and she told me all the stuff about the Bushes and Clintons down there. She was involved in that. So all that was on those tapes, so the CIA just disappeared the tapes.
Mm-hmm.
They just took them all away, which is another felony. Because, you know, under Brady Bill federal law, Supreme Court cases, they can't take tapes or evidence out of your case.
Yeah, you got to follow the chain of custody.
Yeah, to get all the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
So they took the tapes, then they went back to the agent's 302 reports. They filed, in the 2 years of Operation Stingray, they filed reports every day, except on that one day that we met, April 22nd, 1999. They disappeared the 302 activity log. The only day they were gone, so that the meeting never happened, see? And that's what the CIA does when they're sanitizing an operation. So they sanitized the cover-up, you know, the planting me with evidence and covered it all up. Then the agents all lied to the grand jury, lied to the judges and all, and that's what they really did. So we had proof of it. We tried to get into court, and then I got hit in that strange car accident scene in the parking lot and so forth. So anyway, I'm real lucky to be alive. All this is a true story. We had it documented with as much evidence as we can in a 700-page book. We have a big appendix.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a basic story. And like I said, there's a lot more here. We can talk for a long time, but it's going to be the hour or so.
Yeah, I mean, like to what we started with, man, they just keep following the same playbook. I mean, I feel like the Judge Sherwood that you mentioned, he probably just ran out his usefulness, so they had to dispose of him with some hooker cases and whatever else he was doing. I mean, they always run the same ops where they'll use people, then they'll run a night of the long knives and plant something on them. They'll kill them or Arkansas them or whatever.
Yeah, that was Judge Nottingham, not Judge Sherwood.
Oh, I'm
Judge
sorry. I was it was in my brain of the other.
Yeah. And here's an example. We have it in the book, too. Judge Nottingham is judge that was nominated by Director CIA, and he was a cover-up artist.
Mm-hmm.
One of the cases, you may recall, the Joe Nacio Q West case.
Hmm.
Yeah, after 9/11, George Bush Jr. secretly ordered NSA to start tapping all the phones.
Uh-huh.
And one of the companies, you know, there's Verizon, Q West, AT&T, most of them went along with it. and Nacho would not go along with the NSA, so they planted him the fake evidence and got rid of him. And the whole story's in there, and they put him in front of Judge Nottingham because Judge Nottingham was a cover-up artist for the deep state, CIA, NSA. Any case that went there, his job was to make sure it never saw the light of day and that he could rig and control it so that the deep state would always win.
The mainstream media is going to go along with the narrative, so they're not going to publish anything outside the lines.
So people can Google up the thing about Joe Nazi on QS. We have a thing in the book about it here. We have a thing about 9/11. We have an actual copy of the active thermite report in the American Journal of Physics and Chemistry over in Europe. All kinds of stuff in here. So.
Wow. Well, thank you so much, Cody. Thank you so much for the time. I know we went a little over, but thank you so much for really getting into this. My head's blown.
Oh, I know. Yeah,
man.
I'm scattered because it's like I said, it's my third interview today, and I'm starting to get tired. So I hope I didn't make too many mistakes.
No way, absolutely. I mean, my head's blown in a good way. I feel like I have so much more knowledge than I even thought I had a moment ago before we started this whole thing. So thank you so much. Please,
right on.
We got to do this again.
Yeah, if anyone wants the book, it's called Choosing the Light: Dark Secrets of the Oklahoma City Bombing. And here in the U.S., you can get a copy by emailing me at CodyGoldenElk@yahoo.com. And we can get you a copy. They're $20 a piece. And we send them out. They're PDF files on a CD disc. And they're burned on a device unconnected to the Internet, so there's no viruses or data hacks.
That sounds terrific. And we'll definitely have all of your guest information on the website. So please, if you haven't already checked this out, I encourage you. I'm sure this interview was just the tip of the iceberg of what's in the book. So please check this out.
Yeah, John, one time we'll tell the story, and maybe next time or whenever we do it, about what really happened there, and Ron Cole, the guy that was Koresh's buddy, what really happened.
Mm-hmm.
It's unbelievable. It's so different from the federal cover story.
Ah, that'd be great. I've tried to get Dick Rivas, he wrote one of those early books on Waco on the program, but I haven't had a heck of a lot of luck. So,
yeah, it's hard, and I know this is my little part that I know firsthand. There's a lot of other people that know a lot more about me, but what we do, we try to each put our piece of the puzzle together and hopefully get to the truth, because the shadow government wants to stop the truth, and this is a spiritual war between the forces of the light and the forces of the dark. You know, they use lies, we use truth. They use hate, we use love. So it's all coming to a head now. I mean, the events today are swirling around, and there's so much censorship and so much propaganda. The truth is becoming a very rare commodity.
Absolutely. I hope to stay on the air for a little while here. I don't know. The way things are going online, you never know.
Yeah, I know. And if you can, John, when you get this posted or whatever you do, just send me a link, you know, to my email address, and I'll send it out to our networks. We have a lot of them overseas, but they've been blocking my emails and doing all kinds of crazy stuff. So we're being censored into the Stone Age right now.
Yeah, I absolutely will, Cody. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks a lot, buddy.
All right. Thank you, man. Be safe out there. Again, I want to thank everyone for joining us today on the Anomic Age. I don't know about you, but my head is exponentially bigger. I feel like I need to go lay down. That was so much amazing information. Wow. An overused phrase on this show, as I know, but wow indeed. Thank you again for joining us. Please check out AnomicAge.com. Share that link with friends, family, loved ones, and enemies. You can check out everything Cody Snodgrass. I'll have all his links there, so please check out his book as well. I really have a feeling, you know, we spent almost 2 hours today talking. We didn't even scratch the surface of this book, I guarantee it. So please check out all of his information on AnomicAge.com, too. As always, ladies and gentlemen, you can't do everything, but you can do something. So get out there, try to make a difference. Until next time, be safe.
Thank you for listening to The Anomic Age, a John Age Project. For past shows, further info, and to comment, go to AnomicAge.com. That's AnomicAge.com. Till next time, thank you for listening to The Anomic Age.
We'll be right back.